This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to this Family Day edition of Fight Back. Now, starting with the way in here, the drive was a lot quicker and a lot less congested than usual. But the biggest feature coming down here during what I think is an arterial road was big, hard, dirty piles of snow with signs that have been there for days that say, no parking. So I think Olivia Chow's snow removal strategy is spring. And we are getting melting temperatures on Wednesday, I think. So that's what's going to do it. But great big, huge, hard piles of snow. And the internet is full of local people annoyed that she did not show up to support the 350,000 peaceful Iranian-Canadian protesters calling for change in their homeland. Interesting what she decides to show up for and what not. And one of the things families are doing together today is watching the Olympics. So here's my little rant. And I am not the only one ranting about the CBC's taxpayer-funded coverage. So, one of the things, first of all, there were nearly 1,200 complaints to the CBC about excessive and disruptive ads during the opening ceremony. So that's one thing. And the headline in the Globe and Mail said the CBC should not ignore these, really. It shouldn't, even though they're saying, there's not really that many of them. But in our industry, one of the really big irritants is that in addition to their more than $1 billion subsidy, courtesy of us, the taxpayers, they sell ads. So they compete with us. Basically, they eat our lunch. And that is one of the reasons that Legacy Media is in financial trouble. And part of it is that and other government policies. So that is a general irritant. But it's not just the amount of ads that bothers me. It is the kind of ads. We are seeing mostly online gambling, which is not a socially good thing, and private health care. Private health care. This from a broadcaster that claims to be a beacon of the national interest. And as with everything done by the CBC, it is served up with a big side of sanctimony. So, people, what do you think? Am I wrong to rant or right to rant? We have text and phones today. So the text line and the long-distance phone line is 866-740-4740, and the local line is 416-360-0740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Anthony Quinn, president of CARP, and here in studio, because we're kind of like a bit of a family, too. David Valentin, a principal at Liaison Strategies, and Rob Davis, a former Toronto City Councillor. Hello and welcome to you both. Happy Family Day.
Happy Family Day.
Happy Family Day. And, you know, if we're a family, I obviously didn't get the looks of the family, so it's going to be with you guys.
We all look a little bit different. So, I started my little rant for the day. I started my little rant for the day with the snow piles. down Dovercourt was where I was driving, but there's everywhere in the city, and they're now hard. And it looks like the strategy, Rob, is wait for spring.
You know, and that's a terrible strategy. You know, climate change or, you know, global warming is not a strategy to deal with snow. You know, my thinking in particular on this is that the city has sort of failed. For a large city, like, there should be, because, you know, we have cell phones in our possession, there ought to be a way through geofencing to be able to say, hey, if you're in this part of Etobicoke, the roads are going to be plowed on this date and by this date or this time. Set a realistic expectation. You can remove your vehicles by this date and this time. We're going to deal with the snow removal by this date and this time. And they can coordinate it because the technology exists to allow us to know where every piece of equipment is. And they should be able to, because it's mapped out, they should be able to communicate that to people in virtually real time, so that we have a realistic expectation. And one of my big beefs has been the issue of, you know, the plow going north creates a windrow, the plow going east-west creates a windrow, and these corners, these intersections where pedestrians have to essentially make an Olympic game out of getting over, you know, getting over the intersecting windrows at corners. Like, if one politician in Toronto said, you know, I'm going to tackle, you know, that issue, they would be elected mayor. They could say, you know, this is vital because, you know, older folks, people with accessibility or mobility issues, and how about just people who have to walk are not able to get from corner to corner? And this is Canada. We go to work in the snow. Yeah. We go to restaurants and we do business in the snow. But we can't do that effectively, efficiently, and safely if the municipality doesn't take care of the basics.
You know, the big concern for me always is for people who have accessibility needs. Look at the Eglinton Crosstown that just opened. Pretty good launch so far. But if you are taking a bus to the Crosstown, you can only get off one of the exits because the TTC has not plowed or removed the snow so that buses can actually pull up to these stations, especially at night, for you to exit through the rear doors. And at the beginning of the snowstorm, what we saw was a lot of stations where, and bus stops and different stops where there was no plowing done. And so if you're trying to get from point A to point B, you have a stroller, you're in a wheelchair, how are you supposed to access this infrastructure? And I actually saw there were TikToks of some people who took matters into their own hands, grabbed a shovel and said, I'm going to do for as a public service, going to shovel access to the station for people. Well, that's very nice of that person, but I think, you know, why is the TTC not taking care of things like this?
Well, that's a very good question. And with this alleged snow removal, I've been going on about my ticket, and I just learned from here that, first of all, it was less than 24 hours after the actual snowstorm. I pulled in behind a big truck, which was the safest to, you know, get a prescription from the pharmacy. And that they need to give you 24 hours notice. And I guess they have now, but I will be very, very surprised if that snow removal actually happens. I mean, you know, it's not an everyday event here, but we should have money in the budget for, you know, it happens once a year, twice a year, and this started well enough. The city was on top of it right at the beginning, but I think they've gone from hero to zero. Anthony?
Well, how much money do you want them to have in the budget? I mean, that's the question. Do we want to have a crew on standby for potential snowstorms every year, and we get these decade-strong storms every 10 years. I'm not certain that we can expect white-glove service and be crying every time that there's a tax increase from the city. There's a lot for the city to do. I certainly think that they could better use the money, but everybody wants white-glove service, but not willing to pay for it.
Well, wait a minute. So first of all, once in a decade, we had a huge issue with snow removal last year. And less than a year later, we have another huge issue. And as a Canadian, I could say that big snowstorms really are not that rare.
They're not that rare.
They're not that rare. Okay, I grew up in Montreal. I lived in Ottawa as well. They were more frequent there, but they're not that rare. And maybe one of the reserves that Olivia Chow is raiding for something else to make it look like she is a responsible manager, like you have a little money in the kitty if you get a bad snowstorm in that year, and chances are you will. And, you know, it's also poor management, and it can be really quite annoying and dangerous, because I also see large trucks on streets that used to be sort of two-way but are basically one-way, and they've now got cars parked on both sides, and these trucks don't care.
No, they don't. But, you know, to David's point, where was the call for, you know, civic mobilization? Where was the call to say, hey, folks, you know, we could call it lift with your knees. Like, it could be something fun and simple, but it could be saying to people, lift with your knees, come on out, we need a hand. We have a problem. We have a lot of snow. If you want to say it's, as Anthony says, well, it's once in a 10-year snowstorm, great. Hey, if you happen to live on a bus route, can you do us a favor and just like, they could have mobilized the public, the goodwill, the civic pride of people to help out. So it doesn't all have to be, you know, financed by the government, by the city, but there just seemed to be a lack of enthusiasm to get the job done. And that does, you know, and I'm not trying to criticize, you know, Mayor Chow at every turn, but that does come from the top, that, you know, leaders, it could have been the city manager who led that call to action. So I think that seems to be what's missing from all of this, because we have 2 million people who could have picked up a shovel and helped.
You know what? That happens on every street naturally, right? There are always people who shovel a bit of their neighbors for whatever reason. There are people who shovel businesses, probably, like that pharmacy that now has a little bit of a walkway for people that they didn't have right after the snowstorm, dare I say. But we have that. And yes, I think you're right that when there's this, you know, kind of do-nothing attitude, it can spread.
Yeah, and let me be, I mean, it's family day, so let me be nice to the mayor today and say, you know, she came into this and the city had just signed new snow contracts. So a lot of the stuff that she got handed was not helpful by what Mr. Tory signed when he left, you know, on his way out the door. That being said, she's had time now, and they've been making modifications to these contracts, and they're supposed to be adding all of this capacity. I don't know that we're seeing it out in force every day. And to Anthony's point, the way that you're deploying this infrastructure, you know, to me, it makes sense. You're going to plow the major arteries first. You're going to make sure people can use the transit system. Yes, we had a gigantic snowfall, but what did we see? The Finch LRT taken off service for more than a few days. Line 1 taken off service between different stations for the majority of 2 days. So, you know, I think we need to remember that for a lot of people, it's not just cars, it's also transit. And they're relying on these things to get to not just work, but to get to the hospital to visit a loved one, to get to physiotherapy, to go get a prescription, all these different things that people need transit for, right? And if you can't access the station, how are you supposed to get to where you need to go?
Well, a very good question. I'm going to take a call from Helen in Toronto. Hello, Helen.
Hi, I'm so glad your lines are working again. Yesterday, leaving Staples on Steeles, very close to Yonge, I am trying to get out, but the pile of snow is about, I don't know how many feet higher than my car, and that's a very busy intersection. I'm afraid to move forward because somebody could slam me. Meantime, the people in the trucks behind me can see further on, and they're honking, go out. I think that the city's got to do something about the roadway coming out of major plazas or major business centers so that people can actually exit without getting killed.
Well, yeah, good thinking, and maybe the businesses should do that too.
Well, those piles were taller than I am. Okay, I'm not that tall, but taller than I am, and so it was impossible to see over them. You had to be partway into Steeles with traffic coming across before you could actually decide whether or not it was safe.
Okay.
So there's that one for you.
Okay, thanks, Helen. Again, people, you can text, and you can call at 866-744-7740, and the local number is 416-360-0740. And, Anthony, if you were listening to my little rant at the beginning of the show about the ads on the taxpayer-funded CBC coverage of the Olympics, and there's an awful lot of ads for online gambling, which is not exactly a social benefit, especially for young people, and also for private health care. What do you think?
Well, on the online gambling ads, this is such a unique thing for my CARP members, and they will recall a time when gambling was much more prevalent 50, 60 years ago, and there were bookies, and there were a lot of families destroyed by gambling, and that led governments of all stripes to prevent and clamp down on gambling so that it wouldn't be this social problem, and it wouldn't be destroying families. Now, looking for tax dollars, governments across North America have embraced gambling. And when I talk to my four daughters, who are all pretty young, but all of their male friends are gambling regularly on sports. So I think, aside from the advertising of it, it really is a societal experiment that we're going through, and the pendulum is likely to swing back the other way because of the negative effects of gambling addiction.
Yeah, but this is a particular kind of gambling. This is the online gambling, and it, on top of the addictive nature that you might have in a casino or whatever, this increases social isolation, and I just find it, it's the CBC supposedly that acts in the national interest, and you know, this is what they're embracing for money.
Well, it's a challenge because on one hand, we are not necessarily enamored with the $1 billion subsidy. And so the Olympics is an opportunity for them to generate much needed revenue. But the fact that they have to resort to perhaps taking ads from, you know, one of the enterprises with the lowest common denominator, you know, the whole idea of it's a get rich quick scheme, although they don't advertise it that way. They advertise it as exciting and fun and thrilling.
Yeah.
And you're being entertained. But actually, you know, it's an attempt to borrow from a Moody Blues song, I guess, it's, you know, or whatever, trying to get money for nothing, right? It's,
yeah.
It's an attempt at trying to get money for nothing or to utilize your knowledge of sports when it's a completely unpredictable outcome.
It's all random.
It's all random.
It's all random. Your knowledge of
the ball,
anything isn't really going to...
And the ball can bounce any which way when it lands on the field. And so I think that's the real question because... And this is the contradiction because the Olympics is supposed to be this pure thing, this thing devoid devoid of politics. It's young people, you know, setting down differences from all over the world, competing against each other in a what is supposed to be a level playing field. And then at the other end, we're attracting young people to watch other young people participate and compete, and then we're asking them to make a bet on who might win or lose a football game or a hockey game.
You know, I think I would feel so much better about it if we were putting some of that money towards our athletes. And what happens in Scandinavian countries is they don't do the e-gambling the way we do it here, but their lotteries fund their Olympic programs. We don't really have a mechanism like that. And so what we're seeing instead is the CBC is taking out ads for some of the services that cause the most amount of harm. But, you know, we're also watching our athletes who are some of the most... funding-starved athletes in the world, where they are on the hook for raising team fees of $30,000, $40,000, $70,000 to be able to participate. And so for me, it's just this, you know, very sad situation sometimes where we're not only are we seeing the ads could be funding something really positive.
Unlike the CBC.
Yeah, well, listen, there's a lot of places where they're the only game in town. If you're in Atlantic Canada,
right,
particularly.
Right, but Toronto is not one of them.
Toronto's got options, and I think last time I saw the ratings for CBC Toronto, they're dead last, right?
They're dead last, and the now, this year, CTV, Bell Media, is covering some of the Olympics. CBC holds the rights, but do I think that they couldn't get the private sector to pony up? It's like the estimates, because they're not going to tell us what they paid for the rights, but it's something like, Anthony, the order of $75 to $85 million. So the whole thing, you know, it just has me shaking my head, Anthony.
I've been watching the games, not in real time, but on CBC's GEM program. And that requires the signing up to an app. So they're getting your digital information.
Yeah.
And you have to watch at least 2 minutes of commercials before every program starts. And then they have commercials during. So they have really cornered the market on advertising for Olympic coverage. I'm often not willing to pay it when the CBC requires me to watch two or three commercials before something they have produced online. But for the Olympics, I'm willing to pay that price right now.
Okay, I'm going to read a text, and it says, "Hi, Libby. We have hated the gambling ads on TV since they have begun, often endorsed by celebrities for whom now we have much less respect." And I'm down with that. I'm going to read another text. Ed from Dundas, and he's talking about both the CBC ads and the snow. He says, two topics, large snow melters where snow is turned into water and then opened for draining. I truly believe in, if portable snow melters were stationed across southern Ontario, they could be mobilized to the problem area and afterwards be parked at federal properties so no individual municipality buys something seldom used. Okay, do the municipalities fight among themselves when there's a big dump like there was a couple of weeks ago? Handle snow once and early melting avoids flooding too. I don't know about that. Advertising. I have given up on internet media. Trying to read an article is littered with interspersed ads, so much so that I have given up. And you know, it's true, even if you pay for the content, and we pay for content to support whatever journalism, yep. And it is still, and they're kind of stickier, the ads, because yep. I find it much, it takes a lot less to end up landing on one of those ads than it used to.
You accidentally hit the hyperlink to the ad, and all of a sudden you're learning about Spanx instead of reading about the article in question or the column in question.
Are you suggesting that I need Spanx?
No, I'm talking about... I meant the royal you, not you specifically and individually. I meant to all of us, the royal we.
Okay.
We are on scrolling and we hit the Spanx ad by accident, of course.
Okay, for those who are not in the know, Spanx is slimming underwear. It's like the next generation of what used to be a girdle.
There you go.
That's all I'll say. So we've got the CBC, we've got the snow clearing. Then there was the question of this big, huge demonstration, a peaceful demonstration, a demonstration which was planned in advance. So the idea was not to randomly hold up people trying to go about their days. And it looks like crickets from the mayor.
You know, I saw footage of Doug Ford speaking with members of his cabinet and caucus behind him. And he called up one of the people who's head of his security detail, who happens to be of Persian-Iranian descent.
Yeah.
And it was very touching comments by the premier. Very compelling media that he generated as a result. And it just shocked me. I don't know who in the mayor's office is advising her in terms of what to attend and what not to attend. But, you know, protesting a regime that has killed 10 or 20 or 30,000 of its own citizens in the last 2 months who are protesting on the streets asking for change is probably a place where you should be if you're the mayor of a large city, a large urban center where 80, 90, 100,000 of your residents happen to derive their heritage from. Like, it just shocked me. Her absence was sort of shocking, more shocking than if she had said or done something inappropriate. The sin of omission is a lot bigger in this case than perhaps misstepping with some of the other protests and things
well,
that have
happened. Well, yeah, but then you have to ask the question, who does she support? So the Hamas-supporting, kafia-wearing protesters that she seems to support, well, they don't want change in Iran, and Iran funds
right.
most of the terror in the Middle East. So, not to mention how women are treated by that regime, particularly. I mean, it's bad for everyone. So you've got to ask the question, who are the people that she did not want to offend?
It's a very good question. And I think, you know, as I was watching the coverage of the protests over the weekend, you know, I have a lot of friends in the Persian community who were there, and just a very peaceful, very almost joyful, I would say, rally for a country that they deeply love. And they love Canada, too, of course. They're all here.
Yeah.
But, you know, they want to see a positive change in their homeland, as I think most of us who emigrated from other countries do. We love Canada. This is our home now. We put Canada first. But we also want to see positive things happen to our old home, right?
Exactly.
I think it's such an interesting situation, too, because the mayor is usually so good about showing up to dance at Salsa on St. Clair and all these different events where we see her
putting on a Caravana costume.
Yeah. And, you know.
Oh, that was. Sorry.
I know. You can't unsee that. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
But, you know, she's usually good at showing up. And sometimes she'll show up to things where, you know, people want her to show up, but the community doesn't really like her too much. And she'll get heckled or, you know, she's used to showing up to tough crowds. So it's a little surprising for me she didn't go to this one.
Yeah, I mean, it is surprising. And again, you know, this was a planned protest. I hope to interview some people because it wasn't just a big, huge protest here in Toronto, though I did see coverage of the Toronto protest on CNN. And it seems to have been the result of a shout out from the Shah, the son of the Shah, Pahlavi. And the last time I checked in, I'm asking people, so is he really the guy and how much support does he have? And if that is the case, and I have to check because, you know, I don't really know, then he really has a lot of power to kind of make these demonstrations happen on the same day around the world. I mean,
no, it's remarkable. I think, again, maybe we have to also give credit to the Persian community, the Iranian community, for organizing it, for having such a peaceful protest, and for, you know, that message of sort of peaceful protest and having an effect. I think it's having an effect. I think it's confirming to the international community, to governments, that they have a constituency in their countries that support the pressure. And it could be sanctions on the regime, and what it's the community showing support for sanctions, for diplomatic pressure, for all that may or may not happen with the United States and Iran. I think it's very important, and because they're not the so-called thugs and hoodlums that, let's say, that the regime in Iran is suggesting that they are. It's showing that it takes a lot of restraint when you know that you have friends and family members who are being repressed violently. Yeah. So it takes a lot of restraint to protest in the way that they did. And I think it speaks to, if we do get regime change, the type of regime we're going to have is not going to be one of retribution. It's going to be one where there at least would be a peaceful transition.
Well,
hopefully.
Hopefully. I mean, you know, these protests are now, but there was a moment, you know, within the last month, and the moment passed, and it was after Donald Trump said help is on the way, and then help was not on the way. So, you know, there have been so many hopeful moments where people thought this is okay, it's going to happen now. So I think we just have to wait and see how it plays out. And I think what the United States does is a big factor. We have to take a break. And it's, let's call it a special family day edition of Fight Back. So normally I'd be wrapping you guys, but please come back for the next segment. And people, before we go to break, 866-740-4740. And we will be right back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. And I'm here with two-thirds of our panel. We're kind of a family here. I'm having a lovely face-to-face chat with Rob Davis and with David Valentin, and we're talking to Anthony Quinn on the phone or on Google Meets, because Anthony is a big family man, so he's definitely with his family today. And so let's talk a little bit about family trends. And people, I'd like to hear from you. What type of a household do you live in? And are you happy doing that? And are you happy with your family relationships? And of course, there are the families that you're born with, and they're families by choice, like our little family here. So the text and the long distance phone line, 866-740-4740, or locally, the phone only line, 416-360-0740. So, Anthony, according to the 2021 census, a little over 2 in 5 Canadians are married, and about 1 in 10 are living in common law relationships. And in the 10 previous years before that, marriage rates declined by 2 percentage points. What do you make of that?
It seems low, just for what I see amongst my peers and my colleagues. But I'm wondering if the change in marriage is based on the step away from traditional religions and that sort of cultural change that we've seen in Canada and North America over the last several decades. When it comes to the aging of the population, that's the thing I'm thinking of most when thinking of the makeup of the family. And about 20% of Canadians are now retired, or typically 65 plus. That number is really going to increase in the next decade. Well, be the over a quarter or more of Canadians will be retired, and how younger Canadians and older Canadians will react together is one thing I think we have to be mindful of, and maybe trying to connect the younger and older generations a little more closely if they're not connected by families any longer.
Well, yeah, and the fact is that about 25% of people over 65 live in one-person households. They live alone, and sometimes it's by choice, the result of divorce or whatever, but often, you know, your spouse dies, and most of those people are women, because women live longer than men. It's interesting that it's women who are often really satisfied or more satisfied with their family relationships. So what do you think of the demographics, David?
Well, they're ever-changing, and what we're seeing is different family structures, different permission structures have been taking place. Of course, technology is playing a big role in this too, in that before, you would be more socially isolated from your family if you lived far away. Now there's Zoom, there's FaceTime, you can Snapchat or Instagram your family members if you like. So the way that you interact with them has changed significantly, right? And when we look at how some families have set up and adjusted to the new technology that's available, I know some families will have everyone on Find My Friends. They can see where they are at all times, right? I don't have this set up with my family.
That sounds a little excessive to me.
Well, it depends on, you know, I come from a big Latino family, a lot of my extended family, and Brampton and Mississauga and Vaughan. You know, we had three generations until very recently living in one home. You know, it's a different structure. And I think what we're going to see as time goes on is a lot of new Canadians come in. They have a set family structure and then they Canadianize, they adapt. And you can see how a lot of people decide to go out on their own, which is maybe something that they wouldn't have done in previous generations back home. So a lot of different changing structures, but things really change depending on what part of the province you're looking at, what part of the country you're looking at, because different communities have different values around this as well.
Well, you know, you're saying they Canadianize. In some ways, we should follow the immigrants because in terms of the intergenerational. So first of all, the polling that I've seen, immigrants are usually happier with their family than Canadians are. Okay. And the other thing is that in general, apparently one of or the largest household style that's growing, even though it's still very small, is intergenerational families, which makes sense money-wise. It's more affordable and you can arrange it so that each part of the family has privacy, but they're there for each other. They can take care of, you know, the grandparents can take care of kids, or kids can take care of grandparents, all of the above. And, you know, that is more common in immigrants from certain parts of the world. And I think it's something worth emulating.
And that speaks to the success, I think, of a lot of immigrant families. It's because they didn't spend $20,000 a year for daycare. They had Nona or Lolo or somebody taking care of the grandchildren. Abuelita, in the case of David, right?
Somebody's abuelo and abuelita. That's right. But wait a minute, is that grandfather or uncle?
Grandfather.
Abuelo's
your grandfather, yeah.
And
tío is your uncle.
Tío and yeah. Tía. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, no entiendo bien español. Hablo un poquito. So anyway, for the audience that says I don't really speak Spanish very well, but I understand a lot. But here's the point. Those communities have found, in some respects, the key to success, because if the cost of living is driven in part by things like daycare and childcare costs, and an immigrant family has a built-in childminder who also happens to make a really good dinner so that the two working members of the family come home and there's a meal on the table. And at the same time, when that senior has a health issue or some other issue, that there's a support for them. Well, it's mutually beneficial for the different generations, or I guess, I don't know how you say it when it's three different generations, but it's definitely beneficial for all of the generations in the family. The grandkids have a sense of self and history. They're learning the native tongue. The parents are able to work to earn a living to pay rent or buy a house or pay the mortgage. And they're saving money because they know that their parent is with them and safe, not in the homeland where we have to make frequent trips to go help them with whatever it is that they're dealing with. So I just think there's a lesson that can be learned. I'm hoping they don't assimilate completely, because I think it's part of the strength of the communities is the closeness of family. And I think, you know, as a native born Canadian, I think we've lost a little bit of that. And like you said earlier, we could learn from those families and we could do a better job of supporting each other, especially because things are so difficult financially and in these difficult economic times of affordability.
Yeah. Anthony, I mean, you're holding up your end with four daughters, but families with children is kind of a dwindling demographic, and our fertility rate is something like 1.25%, which is not enough. What's your take on that?
Well, necessarily, that means that immigration is the only way we can, A, support the social programs in Canada that we rely on, including a healthcare system, an education system, and a long-term care or old age security system. So we have to have a plan that either or at the same time increases incentives for families to raise children to improve that fertility rate, or create an immigration program that is manageable and meets our needs. We've seen in the last number of years a spike in immigration, and that has caused pressures on healthcare and housing. So we have to plan for that growth, but also, I think, encourage families in Canada today to understand that if they are not raising a family in Canada, then Canada will be much different in the future.
Hmm.
I think we also really have to work at making sure that talented newcomers stay. And this is one thing that we haven't really focused on. We focus on a lot about immigration levels, people coming into Canada. We very rarely think about emigration levels, people leaving Canada. A lot of very talented people come to this country. They have wealth. They have education. In other words, they have options. And at the 3-year mark, 4-year mark, 5-year mark, they're leaving because they've come here. They haven't had an emotional attachment to the country, or they got here. Things were a lot more expensive or a lot more difficult than they thought they were going to be. Their credentials weren't recognized, all sorts of different issues. We have a lot of very talented people leaving the country. So I think one of the things we should look at very seriously is what are our programs to retain this talent, especially when it comes to people who could be working in healthcare, working in priority fields where we need more support?
Well, we have a lot of claims from government that they're making it easier, even for people to move from province to province with their credentials. And, you know, a lot of people who say we have big problems in immigration, it's not immigration of talented people we need, but it's a lot of really random people that we don't need ended up staying here, like when their student visas expired, and some of them, you know, were even in some of these colleges were, you know, basically shams. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a mess because of the lack of control, Rob.
Well, I think there were two areas. There are two areas in my mind, anyway, where there was a bit of a choke point. One is the private career colleges who went out and recruited students to come, and that created challenges around providing housing for them and what have you. And for many, it was like a pathway around the immigration process. And the other one, which is becoming a bit bubbling to the surface, is the temporary foreign worker programs, where, you know, a business says, I'm going to get folks in and it's going to cost me less. And rather than hire, you know, somebody with a permanent resident status or Canadian citizenship, I'm going to bring somebody in from another country. I'm going to bring a ski instructor from Australia. I'm going to bring in a cook from India. I'm going to bring somebody from Jamaica to work the fields at in Niagara to pick grapes, or from Mexico. And it's going to cost me less. I don't have some of the same constraints, financial constraints. And then for some of them, and mostly not the agricultural workers, but for some of them, it becomes, again, a workaround from around the immigration process.
Okay. Thanks so much for staying extra family day. I'm going to do one thing now. Roger in Waterloo says, I want to rant about Canada Post. Off topic, I know, but I want to talk about it. I'm going to take Roger's call. We don't have a lot of time for it. Roger, go ahead.
Hi, Libby.
Hi.
Well, I figured it was Canada Day today, and so to be on topic, I got a little bit of a rant about
A short Canada rant. Post. Go ahead.
Okay. The thing of it is that we're here in the house today. We're retirees. We listen to Zoomer all the time.
Great. Thank you.
And here today, on a national holiday, who comes to our door? Right to the mailbox on our front door, a Canada Post mail delivery person. So here's a union employee probably ripping off the system for 2.5-3 times his hourly rate on a national holiday, and he's getting paid.
Is Family Day a national holiday or provincial holiday?
I don't know. Anyway,
To be fair, it's a provincial holiday, not a national. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's getting paid the regular rate for delivering your mail, delivering your bills, probably. So
yeah. Because there's different industries are governed by different laws. Just another thing to make life more complicated here in Canada, Roger. Enjoy Family Day. Thank you for your call. Big Family Day. Thank you to Rob Davis, David Valentin and Anthony Quinn. We're going to take another break. And when we come back, okay, so here's something that a lot of people did because my husband did it and he said it was just mobbed, and that's the auto show. So we'll find out which cars are hot for 2026 when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, one of the things families will be doing today is visiting the Canadian International Auto Show. It's on. My husband was there yesterday and he said it was absolutely mobbed and he could barely move. So what are people going there to see? What are the hot cars this year? Let's bring in Matthew Guy, an automotive freelance writer for publications like driving.ca. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how are you today?
Excellent, Matthew. So what are people looking for at the auto show? Are they looking for their next vehicle or are they looking at the fantasy cars?
And that's what's so cool about our auto show in Toronto is that you've got both, you know? Someone, you know, if there's families that are thinking about their next vehicle, whatever that might be, a car or an SUV, just about every major manufacturer has a presence at the show this year. And when I was there on Friday, the first public day, I was speaking with some showgoers, and that's exactly what they were doing. They had the kids along, and they were crawling all over the three-row SUVs, trying to find out if it had enough storage, you know, and those types of things. So I think the auto show is a great venue for that. It allows just a stress-free and pressure-free environment that you can shop for a car, shop for your next car.
Well, and, price of vehicles has gone up quite a lot lately. I mean, I'm looking at the last number of years. And also, if I'm not mistaken, Canadians tend to keep their vehicles for quite a while.
You're absolutely right. It's definitely into the double digits now in terms of how long most Canadians keep their cars. And many different reasons. Price is definitely one of them. I think the last metric I saw was the average price of a new vehicle was north of $60,000, which is mind-boggling to this old guy. but there's definitely some great cars, some great built-in Canada cars that don't cost that much. You know, the Honda Civic was awarded Car of the Year for 2026 by the Automobile Journalists Association of Canada, and that one starts in the 30s, and it's built in Ontario. So there's a lot of still cars of that nature that are still floating around, even though the average price is, as you said, skyrocketing more than ever before. And speaking of, you know, really expensive cars, if someone just wants to go and to the auto show this week and look at some of these exotics, there's all kinds of high dollar exotic fantasy cars there. You know, there's a group that has brought in things like, you know, there's a Porsche 911 GT3R, there's Mercedes-Benz SLR McLaren, all kinds of different cool things. And that's, I liken that to being able to have, you know, an ice cream after you eat your vegetables, after looking at the mainstream cars in the show.
Now, one of the things that drives me crazy when I'm driving on our roads is just the size of vehicles. So we're in the city, it's congested, and I see so many huge vehicles, and usually with one person in them, and I can't really see an excuse for them. And even if you're paying a lot of money to park your little car, my little car, there's some gigantic thing next to you that's taking up some of your space. They don't pay more. They tear up more of the roads. And another thing is that the headlights on those very high SUVs can blind you if you're just in a little city-appropriate car.
And the headlights, it's interesting. I had a conversation about that just on Thursday with someone, and they were speaking about how different regulations and such sometimes lead to lights being brighter than are comfortable. And then, of course, there's the raised proportion of it as well, where some of the vehicles are super, super tall. And that doesn't help anybody, you know, just flooding the... Sure, you can see if there's a deer in the trees if you're in a rural area, but in the city, that's not overly necessary with all the other lights. So the person was talking about, and the technology exists for this, that if the car knows where you are via GPS, if you permit it to do so sometimes, and there might be an argument there for toning the lights down just based on where you are, where you're driving. So I thought that was an interesting take on, and it's interesting that you bring it up too. So clearly it's a big deal for a lot of drivers.
Okay, well, but moving back to just the size, why do you see this trend continuing? And I know people who think the bigger the car, the safer it is, but do you see the trend continuing? And is there any kind of awareness? I remember back in the day, we used to think that we were being more and ecologically sound by driving a small car.
For real. And whether it's ecologically sound, you think about the new greenhouse gas targets that were rolled out, you know, starting today, right, with these, some of these initiatives replacing the EV mandate, so-called EV mandate that was being talked about for a while. So the focus on greenhouse gas emissions. But I have found that, yes, there are a lot of really big vehicles. You're 100% right. But some brands, Toyota is a great example. They've been doing a really good job of packing a lot of car into a pretty small footprint. The Toyota Corolla Cross, for example, is not much bigger than a Corolla itself in terms of the footprint that it consumes on the road or in the parking lot. But there's just so much space inside. I mean, I'm a tall person. I'm 6'6".
Wow.
And I fit just fine in a Toyota Corolla Cross, and it's available as a hybrid. It's available as a all-wheel drive. So I do appreciate that those types of manufacturers are still making and bringing out those types of cars. The Toyota Corolla Cross is not an old car. It's something, you know, that has been introduced within the last 2 or 3 years. So there's definitely options out there for if one shops smartly at something like the auto show.
Well, again, do you see any kind of let up in this appetite for trucks, basically? Trucks and SUVs, whether you need them or not?
It's whether you need them or not. I mean, the truck category and has historically been the F-150 has been, you know, the biggest selling vehicle in Canada for many, many years. And I think the biggest non-pickup truck is the RAV4, I think, in terms of sales. And then the car is the Honda Civic. I might have those numbers a little bit wrong there. But generally, you know, people buy what they like. And I do, one of my colleagues says, you know, that the trucks are too, she has an acronym for it that I probably can't say, but you know, they're too big. Because it is difficult sometimes just to put even things in the back of your truck if you're using it for work and things of that nature. And I get why people would need them for those types of tasks. I live in a rural area, and there's people hauling around snowmobiles and firewood and things of that nature. But that same colleague also makes a really good point that people should be looking for a vehicle that fits most of what they need to do throughout the run of the year. If you're buying a big pickup truck just because you're going to the dump once a year, that's almost like wearing your snow boots, your ski boots to work every day because you're going skiing twice in the winter, right? And I thought that was a pretty good analogy. So we always try to encourage people to examine exactly what they do need out of their cars and try to buy with those thoughts in mind.
Okay, I'm going to read a text from Jerry and Markham on cars, and Jerry writes, lack of product and factories idled left the manufacturers in a situation where they could charge pretty much what they wanted, and prices never came down from that point. In fact, they've continued to increase prices since then. And of course, he's referring to what happened in the pandemic, and I have to say I bought a car in 2015, which was very small car, very inexpensive. And then I got another one last year, and it was a slightly better model, but it was something like almost $20,000 more for the same, you know, brand of car, slightly better model.
Yeah. And, you know, your experience is spot on. And then the listener who texted as well makes a really good, really good point. I think the cheapest vehicle, this was something that I just saw on Friday, someone brought to my attention that the cheapest new car right now is a vehicle called the Nissan Kicks Play, which is their previous version of the Kicks that was front wheel drive only, and I think that one was advertised at $19,998, and the plus, you know, fees and whatnot, ridiculous fees and such, and then compared to 2015, 10 years ago when you bought yours, there was cars that were half that, you know, $99,998. You had a Chevy Spark, you had a Nissan Micra, you had those types of vehicles. And it is difficult, I wonder openly sometimes about the so-called dealer markups, and those aren't always at the mercy of the manufacturers themselves. You know, the Toyota RAV4, for example, is very, very popular right now. It's brand new. Some versions are built in Canada, and it's a hot car. And it's a really good car. It's built extremely well. And I've noticed that some dealers have been putting an additional markup on them at the point of purchase. And that's not in the control of Toyota corporate, right? They could frown at that, but the dealers tend to be the ones who may try to make hay, as my dad might say, right?
Matthew.
As an opportunity. But I do think, yeah, you're exactly right about the prices. And I encourage everyone, shop around, bargain as hard as you can, much as you're comfortable, and check out all the cars at the auto show so you know what you're looking at before.
Okay,
you go,
well, I'm looking at the clock, and we are totally out of time. Matthew Guy, thank you so much for that. That is all the time we have for this Family Day edition of Fight Back. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.